These are the Target Files. Journey back with us between the 1970s and 1990s on a TARDIS nostalgia trip as we look back at the novelizations and audiobook releases of classic Doctor Who stories. Accessing Gallifreyan Archive. Subject matter: Time Lord known as the Doctor. Target file: The Macra Terror. Author: Ian Stewart Black. In the far future, a group of humans is living an idyllic existence on a distant planet. Their colony is run like a gigantic holiday camp, and nothing seems to trouble their carefree existence. When one of them claims that the colony is being invaded by hideous monsters, no one takes him seriously, but the Doctor's suspicions are immediately aroused. What is the terrible menace that lurks at the heart of this apparent paradise? Why are the colonists unaware of the danger that lies before their very eyes? And what is the Macra Terror?
Hello, welcome to the Target Files. And today we're going to discuss The Macra Terror by Ian Stewart Black, released in December 1987, and the audiobook read by Annika Wills, brought out by BBC Audiobook in 2016. Well, yeah, I sort of semi-enjoyed it. I'm not very keen on the Macra. They're not the greatest of villains. I think even when they tried to reboot and they knew who, they didn't come across great. But I think it has good points. It has the sort of 1970s sort of mind control feel to it, and the sort of feeling that, you know, if we rely too much on fossil fuels, we're going to run out of them eventually. And what can happen if you, you know, deal with those sort of things and try methods of pollution and mind control, and how people rise up against it.
Excellent. I actually had noticed when I was reading the environmentalism, as you just mentioned, but now you've said it, yeah, it does fit into place, really. I was perhaps more taken with a sort of Orwellian mind control concept of it.
Yeah, it does have that, you're saying it now, I didn't think about that for a second, but it does have that feel of 1984, definitely, to it. Sort of, you know, but he's happy because they're at work and, you know, they're completely controlled, and the whole bit where, you know, Jamie's dancing with them, and the dance, he just makes up something on his own, and they don't mind because they're controlled.
Yes, I think we can all see, even though the episode doesn't exist, we can all see Fraser as a bit of a trendsetter, can't we?
Good old Fraser. Oh, yeah, Hines. Definitely.
Met him many times down the years, and a very, oh, very just nice man.
The man is just fantastic. I've met him quite several times. I think about 3 or 4 years ago, I was at Utopia, and he's just sitting next to you. You can just have a really good chat with him, so he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, of course, battled some serious illness. I think it was testicular cancer a few years ago, so best of luck to him, and hopefully we'll be seeing him at Regeneration's convention next month. I think, is he due to be there this year, Al?
I'm not 100% sure, I need to check that, but I don't think he is.
Yes, just a quick mention. Regenerations returns after a 3-year absence to the Village Hotel in Swansea. It's actually where myself and Alex met for the first time about 5 years ago now, Al. About 2011.
Yeah, it must be about 5 years now. Yeah, we met. That's where we first met. So that's the great thing about Doctor Who conventions.
Yeah, so
you just end up meeting people and talking and having fun, really.
Yeah, and so the wonderful Carrie Woodward, who puts it together, is sort of responsible in a way for this podcast, isn't he, Al?
Most definitely. And I think there are still some day tickets left because he's managed somehow to get more seats into the main academy bit. Well, it will be very interesting.
Yes, and he has a lineup of three classic doctors, Peter Davison appearing at Regen for the first time, and the stalwarts Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy. So I would definitely recommend that if you can snap up some tickets for what is always an excellent weekend here in Swansea.
Most definitely. It's one of the most friendly and nice. As I said, it was my sort of first convention I went to, and Carrie just made me feel right at home. Nobody else did, so I seriously recommend it.
Oh, what's that? Oh, sorry. Yes, that's the money arriving through the mat from Carrie after just advertising Regen for him on you.
Exactly.
No worries, mate. It is excellent. We do genuinely mean it. It's a brilliant weekend, and we can't wait after 3 years to have it back.
Oh, it's just going to be fantastic.
But anyway, sorry, back to the Macroterra.
Yeah.
As this is called the Macroterra Review. Yeah, I mentioned the Orwellian concepts of mind control. In terms of having a larger TARDIS team again this time, the mind control is used through the character of Ben.
Yeah.
How do you feel that was written? How do you feel Ben was written?
I don't think that came across very well, to be honest. You know, he sort of didn't stay in character. I would have liked a bit more of him trying to rebel against the mind control. I would have liked that. You expect that with Ben to be a bit not controlled, and just goes along being controlled and doing what they tell him to do. So I wasn't a great fan of that.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised, Al, they didn't actually take the chance to use Jamie. You know, Jamie being from an earlier century, a little bit more of the savagery about him, you thought he would have been easier to control, don't you, in his mind? But, you know, I'm surprised
I think so, because, you know, he's not as intelligent. And the point, I think, always thought the point of Ben and Polly was that they're meant to be slightly against the sort of system, and the minute they're in a sort of place like that, they're controlled.
Yeah, one of those definite themes is, as we mentioned, Orwellian, the mind controller, hints of 1984 and a whole Big Brother with this controller who's at the centre of things, isn't he? There's a big reveal at the end, but on TV, the controller voiced by Nigel Neal, who was famous for playing Quatermass in the 1950s, early 1960s BBC teleplays. Bit of a big name there. Unfortunately, this story is completely missing, so we can't actually see any footage of it. It's available as a photo novel.
It's interesting, because have they still got the soundtrack from it? Because I'm sure
there was a release of the soundtrack with linking narration by Colin Baker.
Because I used to have it on cassette, so I was about to say that. It was a BBC thing.
Yeah, released a few years ago, and if you log on to the BBC website, there is a free telephoto novel of the telesnaps to have a look at, if you like.
Oh, very interesting. I'll have a look at that.
Also, if you contact Loose Cannon via their website, they're the team behind excellent reconstructions of the missing stories using text on the screen and the original soundtrack and telesnaps themselves. I thoroughly recommend them for many stories.
They're very good. It's a shame this one's been lost. I expect it was quite good on TV.
Yeah, I mean, I'm advertising a lot of other things here, you know. We're not an advertising podcast, but I'll get back onto the themes, Al. Okay, it's also messages in this Macroterra novel of how conformity doesn't really work in society. Would you agree with that, Al?
Yeah, most definitely, because, you know, the whole of this sort of society is being told what to do. You work, you sleep, you go to work, and that most of the time in society doesn't work, I think.
Created happiness, isn't it? Sort of manipulated happiness, really, with the, you know, the singing part, which is quite amusing, and the dancing, as you mentioned before.
Yeah, I think those bits are there because, you know, without those, the mind control would be a bit weird. You know, why am I being controlled? But I did think it's been used a couple of times. You look at other Doctor Who episodes, like with, I was thinking like Delta and the Banana Man, that sort of.
Yeah, Bannerman, but that's good.
Bannerman.
That sounds even better now. That's a secret love. Not a lot of people really rate that story, but it's one of my secret sort of. Who loves that Delta and the Bannerman, the Seventh Doctor McCoy story? I do really enjoy it.
And I think there's a lot of similarities between that and this, I think.
Also, Al, the Happiness Patrol as well, you know, this
definitely
standing
the
up
happiness
to societal
patrol,
conformity, isn't it, you know? And because you have the character in this of Midoc, don't you? And he is the one standing up against the social pressures of the time within the vicinity of, you know, almost holiday site where they live.
From other TV things of the time, like The Prisoner and that, were coming across the issues of not being conformed by your society at the time, I think.
Bit of a theme of the late 60s, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, most definitely. I think that did sort of creep into Doctor Who, but it wasn't as subversive as other things like The Prisoner and that sort of, you know, conformity's not a good thing.
Yeah, not, you know, not hugely dark, this novel. Some would say a little bit plodding. I think, looking at the TARDIS Wikia page, that Nigel Robinson, the editor of the Target Range in the late 80s when this was published, we reviewed his excellent Edge of Destruction review last time. Have a listen out for it, folks, at the usual places where you downloaded this episode. Anyway, Nigel Robinson asked Ian Stuart Black sort of make it a little bit darker, the story, but Ian Stuart Black sort of went against that, and I think he realised his story was more or less for children and families as well. I mean, you can understand reasoning from going back and wanting to sort of have a bridge between this and the later new adventures, didn't
you? Oh, definitely, definitely. It's not dark at all, this way, to be honest, and that's probably what lets the macros down a bit, because you could make that quite dark, and I find them quite fluffy.
Yeah, and even, you know, back again to the mind control, there's some wonderful quotes, isn't there? The doctor telling Polly she's been given words while she's asleep. That reminded me, have you seen the George Lazenby Bond film on Her Majesty's Secret Service?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
When they're up in the, I think it's Pies Maria in the Swiss Alps.
And you have
these ladies who are being sent out into the world by Blofeld to create a virus. And he has all these subliminal 60s lights going on in the lodge where they're living at the time, telling him, you will go out into society, and they're trying to have the whole Big Brother effect of the voice.
I think the best film to show his mind control at that period is The Ipcress File.
Oh, yes. And, of course, there's American Wise. That's this side of the pond, Ipcress File. The other side of the pond in the US is The Manchurian Candidate.
All very good stuff.
Which, of course, The Deadly Assassin, and later Tom Baker Doctor Who story, takes a lot of its influence from, I think, The Manchurian Candidate.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Yeah, one amusing part of the story I found was the Doctor's rejection of conformity through his early rejection of male grooming in the story. He set out to be, isn't he set through some sort of machine that makes him look all sort of smooth and well hair combed and everything? And he goes into scruffy cosmic hobo.
He can't stand it. He's really grumpy, and then he jumps back in and gets him back to how he used to be. So it's that whole 60s no conformity thing, you know, that sort of new Carnaby Street look.
Yeah, but that's sort of the whole outfit that Troughton wears as the Doctor. He likes to almost manipulate his enemies into believing he is a fool, isn't he? He's a scruffy sort of fool.
Yeah, most definitely. He's not, you know, the sort of, you know, cosmic hobo outlook, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's sort of very clever how he works his way through the story and works out the solution.
Oh, that's definitely. The Doctor's completely in control for the whole story, I think.
So how do you feel Polly came across in this story? She was a bit of a disappointment for me. You know, Annika plays her well. A bit of a wet female companion again. That's the thing, Al.
I felt the same, to be honest. Because normally with some of Polly, she can be really strong. Like, we've had her in the 10th Planet, that she's quite strong and, you know, quite feisty 60s. Well, in this, it's like, oh, Doctor, there's a whole bit where Jamie sort of might be killed, and he's just sort of doing screaming, you know, girl act for it. It was annoying me.
Yeah, when you consider earlier than this, we had Barbara Wright, wonderful companion to the first Doctor. A little bit after this, the start of the Pertwee era in 1970, we had Liz Shaw. And then shortly after that, we had Sarah Jane Smith. Disappointing how they sort of went backwards in their approach to females like that, isn't it, Al?
It's just annoying, really, because I think the point of bringing Polly in was she's meant to be like, you know, 1960s, things are changing, and then her character, depending on who writes for her, goes up and down all the time. She's either screaming, oh, who, Doctor, sort of Polly, or she's feisty, and that's why I think she's better, to be honest.
Yes, and I think we've seen Annika talk at Regenerations and other conventions, and she has alluded to that, being a reason as to why she left the role. You know, similar to what Carol Ann Ford really says, is there's only a certain amount of ways you can scream on screen, really, you know, if your character's not getting much more depth written into it.
Most definitely. It's like, you know, you can see why she went eventually, because it was just always the same.
Pretty much, Al, pretty much. Spoken about Medak a little, reminds me a little of, what's the name of the character in the Happiness Patrol?
Oh, I know you mean now.
The guy, very muscly guy with a sort of... positive attitude. He's the outcast there, isn't he? And this is the same thing with Medak.
It's the whole thing with Medak that he sort of completely from the start knows something's going on. He doesn't want to conform. And because everyone else is conforming around you, everybody thinks you're the outsider. But
that's very, very true, Al. You know, it is. He does come across well in the book itself.
Good chapter headings, I thought.
Yeah, the titles, they just tell you what you need to know. It takes you back old 1930s serials, doesn't it? You know, the weekly cinema serials, and even before the early novels, the early sort of, what was it you mentioned on the Daleks last year, Rider Haggard novels?
Oh yeah, definitely, or the John Buchan sort of things.
Yeah, those sort of chapter titles, they just really win and they tell you where you're going, really, don't they? You know, without too much razzmatazz, we have had issues in the past with certain chapter titles, haven't we?
Definitely.
Do you think there's a few sort of silly scenes in this, you know, to do with when the Macro are brought out into the open air and how Jamie escapes from them?
I would agree with that. A whole bit where, you know, he's fighting them off, he's getting trapped by the Macro, and then suddenly he gets out of it. It's not explained, it's like, what happened there?
And Ian Stuart Black uses that very strange turn of phrase. The Macro had came at him at the pace of a slug. So
yeah, a slug, you know, he's not going to be fast, so you could probably walk away from that.
Doesn't really put the threat in there, does it?
Not at all. I didn't think... that's my whole problem with the Macro. I just don't think they're that scary, to be honest. They're like, you know, a crab with something included, basically.
Yeah, you know, I felt they returned in Gridlock, didn't they? The David Tennant story some 40 years after this. And, you know, even then the CGI wasn't that impressive.
They still didn't get them quite scary enough, even about you in Gridlock, because I think it's a good episode, but
I mean,
it was like that. Did you feel with Gridlock they were a bit stuck, they were included at the last minute?
It was, yeah, it was a very sort of happy sort of episode up to then, really, wasn't it, considering the
it was like, you know, the Doctor, concept of a large, you know, traffic jam. Seen it. It's a good episode to watch with David Tennant. It's like, Freeman's not bad in it, and it's like sort of nice, happy cat families in stuck in transport, so it's about sort of pollution and that again, and then suddenly, what are the Macro doing there?
Yes, I think the one sensor clip from Australia that survives of the Macro terror shows a sort of crab claw attacking somebody. You know, people have often wondered, or people who do remember seeing it back in the 1960s on broadcast, have wondered about how scary they really were on a 60s budget. But, you know, I think it will be interesting to see if it was recovered in terms of camera angles. At the time, you know, it can make things appear, fast editing can make things appear scarier than they are, can't they? It can make up for bad model work.
Most of the best sort of model work is done, you know, on a cheap budget.
Yeah, you just have to be that little bit more creative, don't you, really?
Oh, definitely. And there's, the sort of Odyssey film with the skeletons is scary because it's done on a cheap budget.
Without spoiling it, Al, you know, the ending, sort of the way the Macra are disposed of, we won't actually mention how, but do you think that's in vain with the Doctor? Do you think that's a little bit violent for
really,
him?
Really, because the Doctor's not sort of a man who sort of kills anything, really, is he? Normally gives them a chance, and then didn't seem to work for me.
Would it be justified in terms of the way the humans have been manipulated earlier in the story?
Well, it depends, because if you've been manipulated for so long, you might uprise against your oppressors, I suppose.
Very true, you know, but do you get the feeling that a later Doctor, perhaps a Capaldi or a Tennant, wouldn't have gone down the route that Troughton does in terms of disposing them?
I think the later Doctor we have now would have put it in front of them. Said, well, I'm going to kill you, you're going to get squished, basically. You won't say what happens at the end, but something's going to happen to you. If you keep on doing this, then I will do you. He wouldn't have just done it outright.
One thing I've noticed about the very last chapter title, 4 minutes to countdown, there's actually a line in there, what can you do in 4 minutes? And that was actually used in I remembered in the McGann minisode, Night of the Doctor, where O'Hela tells him he has 4 minutes left to live. And he says, you can do it in 4 minutes. So, you know, I thought that was a nice little reference that Moffat had put in there, which I hadn't realised before because I hadn't or seen the Macro Terror before. But
That's what I love about The Night of the Doctor, because it's such a short episode, but you can watch it so many times because there's such a lot of stuff packed into that.
Very true, Al, very true. And the actual ending, how the team returned to the TARDIS, we won't just spoil that, but it is quite amusing. Did you feel it worked in the context of the novel?
Not really. It was just like, I think the problem with it is it was trying to find a way of ending happily, I think.
Yes, and of course they had Shades of the Five Doctors later on, when the Doctor is asked to stay and be Lord President of Gallifrey, he's actually asked to stay and be the new controller of this planet.
Yeah.
You know, he has to find a way of getting away, and it's quite amusingly written in terms of how they actually reach the TARDIS, but I won't spoil it for you, folks.
No, it is quite fun. I think it's a very light-humoured book. It's sort of trying to be not dark at all, and in a way I think that spoils it, because I think the Doctor always needs a little bit of darkness.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Well, on the Who's news this time, the Season 10, Block 2, has started recording in Cardiff. The other major thing that's come out this week is that David Suchet, famous for playing the Belgian detective Poirot on ITV, has been cast as a mysterious character called the Landlord. One of the podcasts we are recommending here is the Starburst Blue Box podcast. There have been two episodes with their top 50 of Target books. And on the second podcast, they are discussing with an interview with David Howe on the original Target book.
Three, two, one.
Big Finish have released something what is slightly related to Doctor Who, as it stars the great Nick Briggs as Sherlock Holmes. Their new box set, The Sacrifice of Sherlock Holmes, was out on Tuesday.
Yes, the cover for the novelisation, published in 1987. Sort of red background to the sky. A good close-up of a crab, really. You know, don't know because of the missing footage what the cover artist had to work on. But, yeah, the so it blends into green crab with the red tentacles sticking out, and you know, it's got the Doctor Who logo on there, but I know you've had issues in the past hour without the Doctor himself being on the cover. Do you think it works for this one?
I think it's quite, as I can remember it, it does sort of stick in the memory, but I don't know, does a Doctor need to always be on the cover to sell?
Yes, I'm not sure if they do. This sells a story, but I think it actually makes the Macra a lot more scary via the cover than they actually turn out to be in the book.
That is my whole problem with them. That's not scary.
Yes, indeed. So not a bad cover, you know, one I might not immediately look at on the shelf.
I think my memory says it's quite a good cover. It sticks out, but it's the whole, does it need Trout on it?
Yes, I think it would, to be honest.
Doctor, if you had Trout on there plus the Macro, would that told you more?
I think so. They just could have sort of slipped him in the corner or something. I don't know.
Is it one of those periods where they weren't using pictures again?
That depended on the artist. I think there was an issue with Peter Davison.
Yeah.
At the time, and his agent about his likeness being used, and an issue then later with Colin Baker, because this novel was released in 1987, which is the back end of sort of
It's probably fixed by then.
The start of Sylvester's era. So yeah, but obviously it's a classic story.
I think that does sort of work.
Very true. Very true.
The
cover artist was Tony Massero. M-A-S-E-R-O. So yeah, he's done a pretty good job. There's a good contrast between the red sky, the black lower part of the crab against the landscape, and the red tentacles pretty prominent. But yeah, something is missing for me. Perhaps the Doctor. Perhaps the fact that I've read it now, I've listened to it now, and it doesn't seem to be, or the Macra don't seem to be as scary within the story itself.
I think they just lack, you know, scariness of the Macra, the way they're brought in, and the pace doesn't seem to give it enough to make them scary. I think the cover is a good cover. I just think the cover doesn't really make sense on its own, where, you know, if you haven't read the book or haven't listened to the audiobook, it probably does.
Okay, on to the audiobook, Alex. Released this month as we record, August 2016, read by Polly actress herself, Annika Wills. Your initial thoughts on Annika's performance of this, Al?
Well, I always think she does a fantastic performance. She's always great at reading the books from this period, and she seems to get Pat Troughton and Jamie's voice really well. She does a good one of Ben as well, so I think she does brilliantly, and had good sound effects, and she sort of makes something what's not that scary a little bit more scary, I thought.
Yes, I'd agree with some of that, Al. Annika, for me, she gets trapped at times. There's other times. I think we had this problem with Katie Manning as John Pertwee. It sounds...
I'm thinking about it now. I agree. There are some bits that aren't quite there, aren't there?
Yeah, she sounds at times like Patrick Troughton has been smoking a lot of cigarettes. You know, a very husky version of Troughton.
I think that's why they get Jamie, I keep calling him Jamie, what, they get him to do all the big finish Pat Troughton performances.
Yes, I think Jamie's very good because Fraser can be a bit high-pitched and feminine at times, can't he? And she gets that down very well. She was very fond of Michael Craig's Annika. She's told us many times at conventions. Michael, who sadly died around 20 years ago, far too young, taken from us, as Ben. But, yeah, she does get his voice down very well. She gives, authority to characters such as the Controller and a good bit of authority to Medak as well.
You know, I thought she was good as to sort of sing song, sort of control people.
Oh, yeah, the songs are brought in. I think we've reviewed Greatest Show in the Galaxy before, where there's a little bit of singing from Sophie Aldred, and that wasn't a great audiobook, to be honest, was it? But
no, to be honest.
Annika has improved on that here. There's a little bit of a sort of Seven Dwarves vibe to it, isn't it, with the singing?
Oh, no, it's something a bit sort of not nice, sort of weirdness to it. I think it works well,
though. It's a little bit creepy at the same time as being quite positive.
Definitely, definitely. But I think, again, what saves it is the great soundscape it had with it.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this it doesn't sort of interfere with the plot, does it, really?
No, it's done at the right level. It's sort of just there when you need it and not when you don't, basically.
I mean, yes, did you feel that it sort of, in the Edge of Destruction we reviewed in the last podcast, did you feel that sort of intruded a little, the soundtrack intruded a little on Williams?
Sometimes, I think it added to the sort of, you know, that one, to the sort of way the TARDIS was falling a bit, and the sort of sound effects that helped there, I think.
The Edge of Destruction was released a good few years ago now, so I think they have improved the soundscapes and the editing within this period, up to this latest release this month.
Most definitely, the soundscapes are very good on these now.
So yeah, pretty happy with Annika's performance there now.
I think so. But I would agree with you on some of the third bits of Pat Troughton can be a bit up and down. But otherwise, I thought it was very good.
But I think she's also wonderful. I mean, people do say that obviously the voice naturally gets a bit deeper and a bit weaker as we get older. But I think she captures younger Polly very well. She speeds up the intonation there, and you really get a feel of her again, don't you?
Oh, most definitely. She knows that character in and out, and she knows how to get it exactly how it was, like, nearly 40, 50 years ago now.
Yeah, scary, really, isn't it? That half a century.
Well, she does know. I find I've met Annika quite a few times, and I just find her voice is stunning anyway.
Yeah, she's a lovely person as well. Of course, it'll be 50 years since she first appeared now this autumn, won't it? You know, the first regeneration is 50 years old in October, so...
Oh, is it really that old now?
Time to watch Adventure in Spice and Time again, folks, to see how...
I think it has to be done.
See how inaccurate it was, really. Shall I tell the listeners the Annika story about the set visit?
Yeah, might as well. I'm sure you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, Annika apparently visited one day and saw Rhys Shearsmith playing Patrick Troughton in an Adventure in Space and Time, made up as a doctor, and he was perfectly groomed, almost in a sort of reflection of the way the doctor's groomed in this MacWatera novel. And she ran onto the set, apparently, and said, no, Patrick's hair wasn't like this, and she sort of messed it up a little. And Annika tells it that she set the production back by a day or two by doing this, messing up continuity for them. So,
that's the sort of thing she would do, though.
Yeah, you know, she wants them to be accurate, you know. I realise it was a stylized production, wasn't it, in Adventure in Space and Time?
Most definitely. It had that feel, the time period, what it was stylized.
I think, you know, I was a bit sort of downbeat and, oh my goodness, how have they got Rhys Shearsmith to play Patrick Troughton? But in that stylized version, he did work. He only has a line or two. It's humorous, and it did work.
You don't see him for that long in that, and it did work, but, you know, I don't think he could have pulled it off for the whole thing.
So, should we round up our final thoughts on the MacWatera, the novelisation to begin with, and the audiobook scores, please, Al?
Novel's okay, except the Macra aren't that great. And there are some good bits with the sort of whole holiday cap and the mind control, and sort of, you know, the way people are controlled. So, I'd probably give the book about a 7. And the audiobook's fantastic. Annika's a really good reader. There are a few niggles for it, so I'll probably give it a 7 as well.
For me, the novelisation, I found it a little bit boring, to be honest. You know, it a little bit flat. Something was missing. It was just sort of plodded, really. It wasn't a hugely wonderful pace. You possibly get the feeling, would it be improved if we found the TV version out, do you think?
Maybe, yeah, if the actual sort of suspense of the macro is better in that than it is in the book or the audiobook.
Because I know Ian Stuart Black wrote some very good fantasy novels later on in his career. You know, and there was 20 years between this TV broadcast and the novelisation. So I did find it a little bit of a plodder. Not great depth to some of the characters, although that might not necessarily be a bad thing in a story about mind control. You know, there's not much room for individuality apart from Medak. For the novel itself, I'm going to give a 6 out of 10. I was really enthused by Annika's performance. She really raised it for me. Excellent soundscape again. So for the audio, I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10, Al.
Yeah, I think that, and I think that's about right. I'm just being a bit measured. I was thinking about an 8, but I think the 7 covers it, I think. Next time on the Target Files, we'll be discussing Doctor Who and the Dinosaur Invasion, Target novelisation, written by Malcolm Hulk. Audiobook read by Martin Jarvis.
Doctor Who Target Files, the Macra Terra Review, featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. I Am the Doctor, originally composed by Murray Gold. Version for this podcast by YouTube user GruelingTerror42. Music from Doctor Who Gridlock, originally composed by Murray Gold. Newsround opening and end themes, composed by John Baker and by Ted Heath and his orchestra. No copyright infringement intended. Doctor Who Target Files, the Macra Terra Review, was recorded in Exeter, Devon and Swansea, South Wales, during August 2016.